The Catra Podcast Conversations for the Curious Essential Knowledge Simplified, your gateway to essential ideas that matter most. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of a Catra AI. Welcome to the deep dive. Today we're tackling, well, a truly massive and foundational text. It's something that has profoundly shaped thought across much of Asia. The Tripitaka, also known as the Buddhist canon.
Yeah, it really is immense. And it's more than just, you know, religious scripture. You could argue it's one of humanity's most thorough, systematic maps of consciousness we have.
A map of consciousness. I like that.
So for you listening, think of this deep dive as exploring a kind of user manual for the mind, a really sophisticated guide for, well, psychological growth and finding freedom.
A user manual. Yeah, that framing works because the fundamental question these texts wrestle with is just so relevant, isn't it? How do we actually live meaningful lives, find some real peace when the world is just constant change and, frankly, uncertainty?
Exactly. It's aimed squarely at solving that core human issue, what the tradition calls dukkha, that feeling of, you know, suffering, unsatisfactoriness, stress. It's universal.
And the texts say this dukkha, the suffering, it's not just random bad luck hitting us from outside.
Right. That's the key insight. The suffering, it argues, actually comes from inside us, from things like craving, pushing things away, aversion, and fundamentally, a kind of ignorance about how things really are.
Okay, so if that's the diagnosis internal causes, then the Tripitaka must be the treatment plan, the system to fix it. But maybe before we unpack the solution, who actually wrote this or compiled it? It's unique, isn't it?
It really is fascinating. There's no single author in the way we normally think of it. And the ultimate source, Siddhartha Gautama, the Buddha, well, he didn't write a single word down.
Nothing. Wow.
Nope. This whole massive collection is actually a scholarly synthesis. It represents collective wisdom passed down incredibly carefully through oral tradition by the early monastic community, the Sangha.
That just sounds precarious. Keeping something so vast and detailed alive purely through memory for, what, centuries? How did they manage that?
Well, the effort was enormous and incredibly rigorous. Soon after the Buddha died, the Sangha gathered for what's called the First Buddhist Council. The goal was basically to codify the teachings accurately.
Okay, so who are the key players there?
Two main figures stand out. There was Ananda, who was the Buddha's personal attendant for years. Apparently, he had an almost perfect memory.
Like photographic or eidetic memory?
Something like that.
Yeah.
He recited all the discourses, the sermons, the dialogues, and that became the basis for the Sutta Pitaka, one of the main sections we'll talk about.
Okay, Ananda for the discourses. Who else?
Then there was Upali. He was the expert on the rules, the ethics, the monastic discipline. So he recited all of that, which formed the Vinaya Pitaka, another main basket.
It shows real intent, doesn't it? Right from the start, they treated it as a coherent, verifiable system. Accuracy was paramount.
Absolutely. And that meticulous process is what gives us the Tripitaka, or in the original Pali language, it's Tipitaka, which literally means three baskets.
Three baskets. Why baskets?
It refers to how they actually stored the palm leaf manuscripts back then. They literally put them in baskets. And this collection is the absolute foundation for Theravada Buddhism.
So we said the core problem is dukkha, suffering, driven by internal stuff like craving. And the Tripitaka is the path, the therapeutic guide to basically root out those causes. Where does this user manual tell us to start?
It starts with the groundwork, discipline. The first of the three baskets is the Vinaya Pitaka. That translates as the basket of discipline.
Discipline, okay. Why start there?
Well, the thinking is, if you want to do the deep work on your mind, you need a stable, supportive environment. The Vinaya lays out the entire code of conduct for the monks and nuns, the Sangha.
Rules can sometimes sound, you know, a bit rigid or restrictive.
Mm.
But if we see it as creating the right conditions for this path to liberation, it makes sense. How do these rules, the Padamokkha, actually help someone reach enlightenment?
Well, they're not arbitrary rules handed down from on high. The Buddha apparently established them in response to specific situations, actual incidents that happened in the community. So they're really practical guidelines.
Ah, so problem solving in real time, kind of.
Exactly. They're designed to minimize conflict, build trust, and just create a space where people can focus on the practice without unnecessary distractions. This basket covers everything, serious offenses, minor points of etiquette, how to handle disputes. It's all about community integrity.
Okay, so the Vinaya builds the container, the stable base.
Yeah.
Where do we find the core teachings, the wisdom for everyday life, and the actual path?
Right, that takes us to the second basket, the Sutta Pitaka, the basket of discourses. This is really the heart of it all.
The heart.
Yeah, this is where you find the sermons, the dialogues, the talks given by the Buddha and some of his main disciples over his, 45 years of teaching. It's vast. And it's organized into five large collections called Nikayas.
And is this where someone just starting out might find something really accessible? I've heard of the Dhammapada.
Exactly. The Dhammapada is in here. It's a collection of 423 short, powerful verses, really potent nuggets of wisdom on ethics, the mind, how to live. It's probably the most widely read Buddhist text for a reason. It's incredibly insightful and, fairly easy to digest.
So practical advice, inspiration.
And also deeply moving stories, like the Mahaparinibbana Sutta. That one recounts the Buddha's last days, his final instructions. It's quite profound. So the Sutta Pitaka delivers the core teachings in a very direct, often narrative or dialogue form.
Okay, Vinaya for discipline, Sutta for the core teachings and stories. What's the third basket? You said it was maybe the most complex.
That's the Abhidhamma Pitaka. It translates roughly as the basket of higher or special doctrine. And yeah, it is definitely the most philosophical, the most analytical part.
Higher doctrine. How does it differ from the suttas then? Why separate it out?
Well, think of it like this. If the suttas are like attending the Buddha's lectures or conversations, the Abhidhamma is like getting the advanced textbook or the systematic analysis behind it all. It moves away from stories and sermons.
Towards what?
Towards a really abstract, highly systematic breakdown of mind and matter. It's basically Buddhist psychology and philosophy rolled into one, presented in a very structured, analytical way.
Okay, that sounds intense. Can you give us the gist of its method? How does it analyze mind and matter?
It is pretty intense. The core approach is to deconstruct all of reality, all of our conscious experience, down to its most fundamental momentary components. These are called dhammas.
Dhammas, like atoms.
Sort of, but not physical things in the way we think of atoms.
Yeah.
They're more like tiny fleeting pulses of energy or momentary events or bits of experiential data. The idea is that everything we perceive, including our own consciousness, is made up of these incredibly rapid streams of interacting dhammas.
So they were trying to map the absolute basic building blocks of reality and perception moment by moment.
That's a good way to put it. They were mapping the mechanics of experience itself. And this is where it gets really interesting for modern folks.
How so?
Because this incredibly detailed, systematic analysis of consciousness, perception, how mind and matter interact. Well, it draws some striking parallels with modern cognitive science and even neuroscience.
Really? Like what?
Like the idea that our sense of a solid, continuous self or world is actually constructed from a countless, tiny, fleeting, interdependent processes. The Abhidhamma was digging into that 2,500 years ago.
Yeah.
It anticipated some very modern insights about the constructed nature of experience.
Wow. Okay, that gives us a great framework. Vinaya, ethics, discipline, sutta, teachings, wisdom, and Abhidhamma, deep analysis philosophy. Three baskets holding a complete system. Now, let's maybe pull back a bit. What are the absolute key themes or messages running through all of this?
Well, probably the most famous organizing principle and maybe the most practical starting point is the Four Noble Truths.
Right. I've definitely heard of those.
They're fundamental. It's that diagnostic framework we touched on earlier. One, there is suffering, dukkha. Two, suffering has a cause, craving, aversion, ignorance. Three, suffering can cease. And four, there's a path to make it cease, the Noble Eightfold Path.
It's like a doctor's approach, diagnosis, cause, prognosis, cure.
Exactly. And it's timeless because it applies to everything from, your personal anxieties or addictions, right up to broader social issues like conflict or alienation. It reframes the problem from, why is this happening to me, to, okay, what's the cause and how do I work towards the solution?
And understanding why we keep getting stuck in suffering, even when we know the truths.
That leads to another huge theme, right? The three marks of existence.
Yes, that's a really profound layer of insight. The three marks or characteristics of all conditioned existence.
Which are?
Anicca, which is impermanence. Everything is constantly changing. Nothing stays the same. Dukkha, which we've discussed, the inherent unsatisfactoriness or stress in clinging to impermanent things. And anatta.
Anatta. That's the not self one. That sounds tricky.
It can be. Anatta points to the idea that there's no fixed, permanent, independent self or soul at the core of our experience. What we think of as me is actually a constantly changing process, a collection of interdependent physical and mental factors.
So suffering comes from us desperately trying to hold on to things, our youth, our possessions, our relationships, even our own sense of self as if they were solid and permanent when actually reality is fluid, it's relational, it's constantly in flux, Anicca, and there's no separate static I in standing apart from that flow. resisting that fundamental nature of reality is basically the recipe for dukkha.
It's like trying to build a dam in the middle of a raging river.
That's a great analogy. True freedom, the text suggests, comes from learning to understand and flow with that current of change, not fight against it.
Which brings us to another key message, I think. This isn't just philosophy to ponder. It's about actually doing something, right? The emphasis on practical wisdom versus just theory.
Absolutely central. The Tripitaka isn't meant to be just read and admired. It's a call to action. It constantly stresses that real understanding, real wisdom, only comes through direct experience, through ethical conduct, mental training like meditation, and developing insight. You have to walk the path yourself to see if it's true.
You can't just think your way to enlightenment.
Pretty much no. It requires effort, practice, and verification in your own experience.
And part of making that wisdom practical is how it's often expressed, right? Through really memorable, potent lines. Maybe we should look at a few of those key ideas or quotes.
Yeah, there are so many gems, especially in the Sutta Pitaka. Okay, one that really captures that blend of deep insight and the call to action is supposedly one of the Buddha's very last statements.
Okay.
All conditioned things are impermanent. Strive diligently.
Wow. Simple, but packs a punch. It connects the philosophical truth. Everything changes directly to how we should live. With urgency, with effort, don't waste time.
Exactly. And then there's guidance that's incredibly relevant for how we deal with a conflict, personally or even globally. This one's from the Dhammapada.
Let's hear it.
Hatred is never appeased by hatred in this world. By non-hatred alone is hatred appeased. This is a law eternal.
That feels revolutionary even now. It's saying the only way to actually end conflict is through its opposite, through compassion, non-violence, understanding, not more fighting.
It posits non-hatred or loving kindness as an active force, the only force that can truly transform enmity. It's not passive acceptance. It's an active practice.
And one more, maybe something about the individual path.
Right. There's that powerful call for self-reliance, for taking responsibility for your own journey. It goes something like, be a lamp unto yourselves, be a refuge unto yourselves, take yourselves to no external refuge. Hold fast to the Dhamma, the teaching, as a lamp.
Be your own light, your own guide. Don't just rely on external authority. Rely on the teaching and your own investigation of it.
Precisely. It underscores that radical personal responsibility for your own liberation, which actually makes these ancient texts surprisingly relevant for modern life, wouldn't you say?
Yeah, absolutely. So how are people using these ideas, these practices, like today? Let's talk real life applications.
Well, one huge area is mental health. Remember the Satipatthana Sutta we mentioned briefly? The foundations of mindfulness.
Mm-hmm.
That text provides the detailed blueprint for modern mindfulness practices, especially mindfulness-based stress reduction, or MBSR. It's used worldwide now for anxiety, depression, chronic pain.
So that practice of just observing your thoughts and feelings without getting swept away by them, without judging them instantly, that comes directly from the Tripitaka.
Directly. It's about training the mind to relate to experience differently with awareness and non-reactivity. It's essentially psychological first aid developed 2,500 years ago.
Amazing. What about, say, relationships, dealing with difficult people?
Yes. That's where the practice of loving kindness or metta comes in. It's a specific meditation technique taught in the suttas.
Metta. How does it work?
It's a systematic method for cultivating feelings of goodwill, kindness, and warmth, first towards yourself, then loved ones, then neutral people, then difficult people, and eventually all beings. It actively works to counteract anger, resentment, and ill will. It helps build patience, forgiveness, basically strengthening our social emotional muscles.
So actively training yourself to be kinder, even towards people you find annoying or hurtful. That sounds challenging, but powerful.
It is. And then there's dealing with the big stuff, loss, grief, major life changes, job loss.
Yeah, the things that knock us off our feet. How did the teachings help there?
By deeply reflecting on and internalizing the teaching of impermanence, Annika. Truly understanding, not just intellectually, but in your gut, that all situations are temporary, good times, bad times, health, sickness, life itself. It builds incredible resilience.
Because you know that even the worst pain won't last forever.
Exactly. And also that clinging too tightly to the good times sets you up for disappointment. It helps you navigate the natural ups and downs of life with more balance and less, well, dukkha.
Okay, so this has been a really rich dive. If you had to distill your main takeaway, what really stands out for you about the Tripitaka after revisiting it like this?
For me, I think it's the sheer systematic nature of it. It's not just a collection of nice ideas. It's this incredibly detailed, coherent framework. It offers these really sophisticated, practical solutions to deep human problems. problems we still grapple with intensely today, like anxiety, division, finding meaning. It suggests the answers aren't necessarily brand new, maybe just forgotten or overlooked.
Yeah, what strikes me is the kind of ambition of it all. It's trying to be a complete guide, ethics, deep meditation techniques, philosophy about the ultimate nature of reality, all integrated into one path. It feels like a comprehensive training manual for the mind, aimed at fundamentally transforming your entire experience of being alive.
Mm-hmm. Which leads us, maybe, to a final thought for you, the listener, to mull over.
Go for it.
The paradigm shift the Tripitaka really pushes for. It's about moving away from seeing the world and ourselves as
right.
based on separation, competition, fixed identities, the very things that cause suffering, and moving towards a view grounded in interdependence, constant flow, and cooperation.
So the challenge is, can we make that shift?
Can we truly see that our own peace, our individual well-being, isn't actually separate from the peace and well-being of everyone else? The texts argue they're fundamentally intertwined. Individual awakening and collective healing might just be two sides of the same coin.
A powerful thought to end on. See you next time with another remarkable thinker, another powerful book, and another idea that has shaped our world. This audio summary is brought to you by Akhotra Foundation.